I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Cyber technology, biotechnology, robotics, and other advances in technology have undoubtedly made our world better, but technology is power, and in the wrong hands, it has the potential to wreak havoc on individuals and societies. Joining us to talk about the technologies of attack and potential threats is Gabriella Blum, a professor of human rights and international humanitarian law at Harvard Law School and co-director of the Harvard Law School Brookings Project on Law and Security. She's also the co-author of The Future of Violence, Robots and Germs, Hackers and Drones, Confronting the New Age of Threat. She wrote that with Benjamin Witz, who is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institute and editor of Lawfare. Gabriella Blum joins us from our studios at WGBH in Boston. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So set the stage for potential threats. In the book, you have this hypothetical story about someone stepping into the shower and seeing a spider. So pick up the story from there.
So the spider could be real and either harmless or venomous, but the spider could also be a surveillance drone, just a miniaturized surveillance drone that your neighbor is sending to after you because she dislikes your noisy dog. And while you're getting naked, she relays photos or the live pictures of you on the local sports bar on large TVs. Or more menacing option is that the spider drone is actually a lethal drone sent by your business competitor who's vacationing in Provence and is just monitoring and operating that lethal drone with their iPhone. And we don't have that technology yet, but we're getting very, very, very close. So dragonfly-sized drones with surveillance capabilities are already out there on the private market for you and me to buy. And making them lethal is just the next step.
Yeah, you, I was just going to say, is how close are we? Because you said this doesn't exist yet, but technology is changing all the time. I think in the conclusion of the book, you wrote something about that. You wrote, says, much of what we think we know about privacy, and this, that, one, is you, that the time this book is read, it will be out of date. Quote, technology
right.
hurtles forward at such a pace that today's surreal is next week's old news. And this sounds like something of science fiction.
So the reason we started thinking about this was, you know, everybody was talking about targeted killings in Yemen and Pakistan, where the CIA or the military is sending these large drones after suspected terrorists. And not that it wasn't an important conversation to have, but we thought that something was missing from this picture. And what was missing was the idea that drones were the province of the CIA or the U.S. military. But in fact, what makes them so scary to me is that it's not such a sophisticated technology. It's not made solely in the industrial defense complex. It's a technology that is widely available to everyone. And it's promoted by academia and private sector companies. And your children can buy it and we can buy it. And there's no monopoly over that technology. So the question now, what happens not only when the military uses it, but when everyone among our citizens can have access to it.
Now, anywhere in our country, anybody could be carrying a gun, and you and I could be a target. The Boston Marathon bombings illustrated that individuals already possess the means to kill and maim hundreds of people anytime. So how does the violence you explore in the book differ from the threats that we already face?
That's right. So it doesn't take sophisticated technology to kill people. And if somebody wants to kill some other person, they have the means to do it. They're readily available. The new technologies are not going to replace that. They don't displace the previous older technologies. They just add to the mix. And why is it scarier? For a couple of reasons. First of all, to shoot someone or even place a bomb, you need to get very close up. So there is an amount of risk-taking on the part of the assailant. The technologies we're talking about, especially when you're thinking about bioengineering or robotics, allow you to strike from a distance. Certainly cyber is the prime example of that. So you don't have to be anywhere near your target, which means you can be also far away, even in a different jurisdiction, making attribution and accountability far more difficult. The other thing is the psychology of it. It takes a particular kind of person to take a hatchet to somebody's head. Mm-hmm. The mediating nature of these technology means all you need to do is click a few clicks on a mouse or a keyboard, And it may just be attractive to a different kind of person or organization or even a country to engage in these acts of violence versus the more traditional ones.
Mm. Now, in the book, you look at the role of government in keeping citizens safe. And you start with Hobbes and Locke. Describe what they believed was vital to a liberal democratic state.
Hobbes began with the idea of the state of nature, where absent a Leviathan, what he calls, or a state, absent a controlling mechanism, institution, we're all subject to a life of threat and danger from our fellow human beings. And it takes the Leviathan, or a state, and this is he writes at the beginning against the backdrop of the Civil War in England, but it's to justify the idea of a state, is to help us escape that state of nature, to surrender in a contract where we surrender our right to use violence to the central government. And in exchange, that government protects us from each other as well as from internal and external threats. Locke's important addition or variation on Hobbes was the understanding that the government itself is a source of threat. It's not just other people or other organizations. It's the government itself that needs also to be checked because it can also perpetrate lots of acts of violence. And in the book, we raise the question, what happens when we live in this world of what we call many-to-many threats, where individuals are so empowered, individuals and groups and corporations are so empowered that they really pose a threat to anyone, anywhere around the world. This is, of course, an exaggeration, but if you take it to its logical conclusion, what then is the role of the state? How can the state really protect us when the balance of power shifts to such a great degree?
And so then the question is, can a government remain legitimate if it can't protect its citizens?
Right. And it's interesting, you gave the examples of guns. So guns are actually an interesting analogy in the sense that they are definitely a technology of mass empowerment. And they do some good, but they also do lots of harm. And as a society, the United States of America decided that in the Constitution to keep guns largely out of the sphere of regulation, not to allow any governmental regulation of that. Now, consider a different technology of mass empowerment, which is the passenger car. Passenger car, we're talking about 2 tons of steel driving in high speeds on roads and highways. That is a technology that does a lot of good, but can also cause a lot of harm. And there, as a society, we made a completely different choice in relation to guns, where we demand licensing, we demand testing, we demand training for drivers, identification of both the driver and the car, license plates, insurance, etc. So there is a much closer and tighter system of regulation that we thought would make driving possible and safer at the same time.
So let's talk 2 pieces of technology that have become integral to our daily lives, cell phones and the internet. Let's start with the internet. We hear a lot about cybersecurity. What are some of the potential threats we should be thinking about, both on an individual and societal level?
They're really endless. So the wonderful thing about cyber, as you said in your opening remarks, what's great about technology is that it allows us to do many, many wonderful things. And in that sense, the more correct analogy is not perhaps handguns, but more knives. So imagine banning knives. We can't do that. We rely on knives for so many things. And we rely on cyber and the internet for everything. If you wanted to get off the grid today, it's virtually impossible when you live in an industrialized and developed world. It also means that everything in your life today is dependent on the internet. It's your banking system, your electrical grid, your water supply, transportation, allocation of utilities, not to mention just everyday activities of shopping, communicating with people, et cetera, et cetera. And the more ubiquitous it becomes and the more dependent we become on it, the more vulnerable we become at the same time. So just to take one example, now there is this new thing called the Internet of Things. We're making things smarter. So your refrigerator becomes smarter. It will allow you to know when you're running out of eggs or milk. Your refrigerator will send you a notice. Your car is now a smart car because it has an entertainment system, a navigation system, and a central computer system that controls the car. can talk about your house, electrical, climate control, entertainment system, et cetera, et cetera. So all of these things are wonderful, but it also means they're vulnerable. So a couple of hackers demonstrated that they can hack into the Jeep Chrysler central computer and basically take over the Jeep while on the highway, eliminating the possibility of the driver to control the car.
Yeah.
And this is just one example. There are other examples of hackers hacking to a sniper rifle that was aided by a computer to make the target more or the firing more accurate. But once you hack into that computer system, you basically take control over the sniper rifle and it aims at a different target than what you were thinking.
Yeah. And, you know, that the Jeep, the two guys that you're talking about that hacked into that Jeep, that was, if people want to know more about that, that was in what, Wired? Wasn't that in Wired?
Wired magazine.
Yeah, that's exactly. I'm sorry. Right. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. So the fact that all of our objects, even our everyday objects, are becoming more computerized, more sophisticated, also means they're becoming much more vulnerable to hacking, to viruses, to just mishaps. Doesn't even have to be malevolent. Mm-hmm. It can just be some bug in the system. And the intertwining of these systems means that more of us become vulnerable to any one single mishap.
Yeah. Many perpetrators of cyber attacks come from outside the U.S. What kind of authority does the United States have outside of our borders?
Very little. So in the book, we discuss, we illustrate this problem with offering the real case of a guy by the name of Luis Mijangos, who was operating from Northern California. He hacked through malware the computers of dozens of girls and young women, installed a malware that surreptitiously took pictures through the webcam of these women and girls, and then he used these pictures to sextort, this is what the FBI used the term, sextort his victims to providing him with sex tapes. And the FBI estimated that there were dozens of victims and many more probably went unreported. Now, the FBI ultimately manages to get a hold of this person because he is in Southern California. So they can come to his door, do a search in the house, his computers, confiscate them, bring him to justice, try him, convict him, and send him to prison. Now imagine that somebody like Mijangos is in Nigeria. Mm. Nothing in the facts I've described suggests that he has to be in California in order to do the things he did. He could have just as well done it from Nigeria. What can the FBI do then? Very, very little. Mm. And part of the problem we're describing is that our system of regulation of domestic laws and international laws still presume a very state-centered system where each state takes care of its own laws and enforces its own laws. But our prediction is that that system is going to come under increasing pressure because the United States is really becoming much more dependent on the security in other states.
Yeah. So we mentioned cell phones, and cell phones are essentially mini computers. You can use cell phones many ways. They can become weapons of agents of destruction.
They can. And I mentioned earlier, if you just wanted to operate a drone, you know, we used to have joysticks or to fly, you know, unmanned aerial vehicles. Now your drone can do that. And the drone is a computer. It's connected through cyber. It has much more of a computer capacity than most of the computers we knew up until about 10 years ago. So it's certainly a delivering means just like your desktop computer.
Yeah. And they know where you are. Your cell phone.
They know where you are. You can be traced through your iPhone at any given moment as long as you're connected to anything. You're traceable. There are questions about your privacy, and the questions of your own security as much as the ability of yourself to inflict harm on others.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's scary stuff. But and I know you didn't write this book as to scare people. It's more to get conversation going, to be thinking about this, about the potential threats and what may be down the line, right?
That's absolutely right. And also to get citizens much more involved in this conversation in a more informed way. You know, as we were finishing the book, the Snowden leaks came out, and there was a very strong backlash against government surveillance, government involvement, a very deep distrust of the government. And as I said, you know, John Locke understood that the government, too, is a source of power, and power, if goes unchecked, is not a good thing. But we also wanted to sort of maybe add some balance to the conversation, the sense of reminding our readers that the government plays a vital role here. Because, and the reason it plays a vital role is because the threat that emanate from the big brother are now not so much bigger than the threats that emanate from lots and lots of little brothers here or elsewhere around the world. And your government is supposed to protect you. And the way to protect you would have to require some element of regulation, even surveillance, intervention in our daily commercial and private lives.
Mm. We're talking with Gabriela Blum. She's the co-author of The Future of Violence, Robots and Germs, Hackers and Drones Confronting the New Age of Threat. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Gabriela Blum, who is the co-author of The Future of Violence, Robots and Germs, Hackers and Drones Confronting the New Age of Threat. You write in the book that the right to keep and bear arms may pretty soon mean, in practice, the right to keep and bear robots. So give us an example of how criminals might employ robots.
So robots can do anything that arms can do, and they can do it better in the sense of being able to control their accuracy better, and they can do it from a distance. So this is exactly the difference between sending a drone to perform a targeted killing operation versus using a manned plane dropping a bomb or any other kind of munition. And so all you need if you wanted lethal capacity is really to hold that kind of machine that could do exactly what a gun can do, but it can do it from further distances, and which would make tracing it back to you just more difficult. Mm.
And, of course, not all robots have artificial intelligence, but I'm going to take a little detour here. Artificial intelligence refers to machines and software with human-level intelligence, and many are concerned that artificial intelligence could create new and dangerous challenges for humanity. I'd like you to hear some thoughts on artificial intelligence and its potential threats. But first, WCAA contributor John Wolfson takes us to MIT, where researchers are developing cognitive robots.
On a sunny afternoon in Cambridge, Massachusetts, MIT artificial intelligence researcher Aris Karpis is showing off some of the latest developments in how robots can interact with humans. Inside a glass-walled lab, Karpis stands in front of Baxter, a friendly-looking red robot that's been designed to work alongside people.
If you go into factories now, like car factories, right, you'll see that the robots are isolated in safety cages. And whenever a human enters the cage, the robot just stops for safety, right? Because the robot will just kill the human if you know, he's in there.
Fortunately, Baxter is different.
So Baxter is a safe robot for humans to be around. That's probably the most important thing.
Karpis is a postdoc fellow in a research group at MIT's renowned Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. The group's aim is to develop cognitive robots, ones that can think and act like humans. Baxter's not quite there yet. Robots that can effectively mimic people are a lot further off than Hollywood would have you believe. But even though he's still just a prototype, Baxter's pretty clever. Karpis says he could one day do things like assist a worker whose job is to apply fasteners, known as clecos, to airplane wings.
So if I pick up the plier, Baxter would hand me the cleco. And if I pick up the cleco, Baxter would hand me the plier. And it doesn't do that by, programming an if-then statement, but it actually does that by reasoning over the plan and figuring out what it is I need and what do the choices I make entail for the possible continuations of the plan.
Baxter, who all but whistles while he works, seems like a happy little fellow who just wants to use his artificial intelligence to help people build airplanes all day. But what if he actually represents a grave threat to mankind? Some of the sharpest scientific minds on the planet are worried that well-intentioned AI research projects, like the one going on in this laboratory, could someday spell the end of humanity. They worry that machines could eventually become so smart and so powerful that they decide to simply do away with people altogether. And that puts Baxter right in the middle of a debate that's tearing through science. Does artificial intelligence represent an existential threat to humanity? Do we need regulation and oversight of AI research and development? The world's most celebrated scientist, Stephen Hawking, thinks so. Here he is explaining the threat on HBO's Last Week Tonight.
There's a story that scientists built an intelligent computer. The first question they asked it was, is there a God? The computer replied, there is now.
Evil robots with godlike powers is certainly a terrifying scenario. But MIT physics professor Max Tegmark says advanced AI wouldn't have to be evil to be dangerous.
Rather, what you have to worry about is that some very intelligent entity has some goals, which sound very reasonable, but that might conflict with our human goals. I don't have anything personally against ants. I will never go out of my way to step on an ant, and I'll go out of my way not to. But if you put me in charge of building a hydroelectric dam, which is going to provide a wonderful clean energy to a large region, and there's an ant hill in the middle, you know, too bad for the ants.
Tegmark co-founded a group called the Future of Life Institute, which is made up of scientists concerned about AI. Over the past few months, hundreds of prominent science and technology thinkers have signed an open letter from the Institute calling for responsible AI research. Add to their voices a parade of superstar businessmen and technologists, Elon Musk, Bill Gates, and Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak among them, who have sounded the alarm about AI. But to some influential AI researchers, all of this sounds more like uninformed hysteria than a reasoned path forward. At a conference this spring, the distinguished AI developer Andrew Ng dismissed the, quote, hype that AI will create evil robots with superintelligence. Ng's message resonates with many AI researchers. Standing next to Baxter the robot, Erez Karpis quotes Ng to me.
He's not worried about, AI taking over the world, and because of the same reason he's not worried about overpopulation on Mars. Maybe it will become a problem at some point. But, you know, we don't have to worry about it now.
So just where are we with AI today? How smart are the machines right now? How fast is the technology moving? And how likely are we to wind up with computers that can outthink us? Back in the glass-walled lab, Karpis instructs Baxter the robot to raise his left arm. Using a computer monitor, Karpis identifies where he wants the limb to end up, but it's left to Baxter to decide how to move his arm joints to get there. Karpis stares at his monitor and punches a few keys. Satisfied that Baxter has settled on a reasonable plan, he instructs the robot to begin. Baxter springs to life. A few seconds later, Baxter's arm is precisely where Karpis wanted it. Raising an arm hardly seems like rocket science, but Karpis says there's some impressive technology involved in the process. Baxter employs a randomized algorithm, which means that instead of solving a problem the same way over and over, Baxter can solve it one way today and another way tomorrow.
So this falls under the broad field of artificial intelligence. This is different than what's hot now is those deep learning networks, right? So it's not that sort of artificial intelligence. You can say it's old school AI.
What about those deep learning networks? MIT professor Randall Davis says the computers of today can interpret reams of data. This allows them to do things like, say, figure out even before a doctor does, which patients in an ER are likely to get worse rather than better.
So the ability to take the enormous volume of digitized data that's now available from sensors of all sorts and look through it to find interesting trends, that's the payoff of machine learning these days.
In other words, computers are now capable of learning from experience. Our experiences. Pretty impressive. But as far as I could tell, the current state of artificial intelligence is nowhere near what's presented in movies such as The Matrix, Terminator, or AI. Right now, getting your robot to hand you the right tool seems to qualify as an AI breakthrough. But Future of Life Institute co-founder Max Tegmark says it's not where we're at, it's where we're headed. When people think of artificial intelligence, he says, what tends to come to mind are milestones like a computer beating a chess master, or winning at Jeopardy, or driving a car.
However, these breakthroughs were all done largely with good old-fashioned AI, where a lot of the intelligence was actually programmed in by humans. The most remarkable breakthroughs in the last few years, I think, are of a different kind of intelligence, which is learned. Where the computer actually learns like a child and has the ability to develop intelligence and skills that the creator simply didn't have at all.
Learning like a child. That sounds almost sweet. What's the danger in that? I ask Tegmark why it's so hard to get people to see the threat that he does.
Imagine going up to somebody in 1915 and saying, you know, I'm concerned that in about 40 years, someone is going to build this thing called a nuclear weapon. And you're like, what? Oh, and you explain. And then there might be an arms race between two superpowers that also, by the way, don't really exist yet. And it's going to threaten humanity. You might be like, get out of here.
But Erez Karpis, the MIT postdoc working on Baxter, insists that the warnings about AI are coming largely from people who don't understand the technology.
If you look at the people with all those, you know, doomsday prophecies, and if you look at how many AI systems they actually built, you will arrive at a very, very small number. So certainly, you know, AI will become smarter and more capable, and computers will become faster and bigger and better. But getting to the point where I will actually be afraid of my computers, no. Maybe my grandkids. Maybe.
Perhaps that's so. But there's a lot riding on the choices we make today about artificial intelligence. To scientists like Max Tegmark and his like-minded colleagues, we're at the biggest fork in the road in human history. And if we choose wrong, there may be no coming back from it. For WCAI, I'm John Wolfson.
All right, Gabriella Blum, what are your thoughts on the potential threat of artificial intelligence?
So I'm not a scientist, and I don't know enough about that side of technology to have an intelligent, informed opinion about where we are. What I can certainly agree with is that it's a mistake to think in two ways. One, that there's a, you know, that there's this gap that, you know, our grandkids are going to have to think about that, but we're not there yet. I completely agree with John Wolfson, who says, you know, there are choices we are making today that are going to affect that and what's possible two or three generations from now. And also, the letter that was mentioned, at least the letter that I saw, the open letter by scientists, talked about threat technologies in the military or the defense system, that building autonomous weapons or weapons with AI technology. And one of the MIT professors who was quoted in your story, I think, got it exactly right. It's impossible to think about these things in a siloed manner. It doesn't matter if the technology you're developing is to aid the elderly or the disabled, which is one of the wonderful things that AI technology is supposed to generate, or advances in medicine, or many wonderful beneficial things that we're going to get through AI, and then say, and we can actually slice off or cordon off anything that is going to be used to threaten people. That's just impossible. And this is what's so different from nuclear weapons. When you think about nuclear weapons, you can really control access to nuclear weapons. It's hard to get your hands on the materials. It's hard to get your hand even on the science. A lot of this is still very classified, very controlled. It's a really hard thing to build a nuclear weapon. It takes a very long time. It takes a state-like capacity to do it. Very few states can actually do it. There are lots of setbacks. It's a hard thing to do. Technologies that we're talking about are widely available. There is no monopoly over them. And once there is no monopoly, either through on the access to the materials or the science or the operation or the production, then you can't say, I'm only going to develop it for sectors A and B, and I'm not going to allow it for sector C. Once the technology is there, anybody can use it in any way they want.
There seems to be a fine line between Americans expecting the government to protect us against crimes and fear that individual privacy rights are being violated to do so. At the same time, there seems to be some privacy rights we readily consent to, such as TSA screenings at airports. What are your thoughts on how Americans perceive the relationship between privacy and security?
I think that's exactly right. So surveillance is an evil word in our everyday jargon. We use surveillance. Surveillance already has bad connotations. But the fact is that we subject ourselves to lots of surveillance, only we don't call it that. So security airport security screening is precisely one such example. We call it security screening. We don't call it surveillance, mm-hmm. although in fact it is surveillance. And the reason we happily subject ourselves to it, well, happily or not happily, but readily, is because we don't want to trade off the liberty to fly against the security of our flight. We understand that the two are one and the same, that if there is no security, there's no liberty. You can't really trade them off. They're not in a balancing game. You give up some, you gain some. Your liberty and security in terms of airport flight and the security of our air travel is one and the same. Same is true if you think about what we call community policing, when you have a police officer near a playground. And we like to see that police officer near the playground because we think they're performing an important function of making sure that our playgrounds are safe for children and parents to play in. And we don't call it surveillance, but in effect, it is surveillance. So our attitudes towards surveillance has a lot to do with sort of what is it that we're trying to protect and what is it that we're fearing? Mm. How important is the goal? How serious is the threat? What does the collector of the information do with that information? How intrusive is the collection? Are there some checks and accountability to the authorities, over the authorities that collect the information? And once we have that kind of conversation, instead of calling something, is this surveillance? Yes or no, surveillance is bad. Bad for privacy, etc. Then we're starting to have a much more informed conversation about what is it that we're actually concerned about and what are we willing to do about it. Mm-hmm. Now, the other side of it is that most of this conversation about surveillance is vis-a-vis, the big brother, the government. But think about how much private information you readily and willingly divulge to lots of private corporations in the United States and around the world. You happily give your financial information, sometimes your medical records, your credit card, social security, lots of very private information that for transactions on the internet or for services, you just hand over to these private corporations. We don't really have an informed and comprehensive conversation about what these private corporations owe you. What do they owe you in terms of your security, of your privacy, of your liberty? And then we also need a conversation about what is the right relationship between the government and these corporations. So I'll just give you one example. When you think about drug safety, pharmaceuticals, or the food safety, safety of food you consume, the government can't make sure that the medicine you take or that the food you consume is safe. It doesn't have the capacity to make sure that every pill and every donut are safe. Instead, what the government does is it forces the private companies to make sure that their products are safe through a whole system of regulations and checks and torts, accountability and compensation if anything goes wrong, and liability, both civil and criminal. And this is the kind of conversation we should be having as a pertains to the relationship between the government and the private sector that offers you all kinds of internet-based services, telecommunication, anything that doesn't seem to be implicating security, but at the end of the day is.
Yeah. We're talking with Gabriela Blum, the co-author of The Future of Violence. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Gabriela Blum, co-author of The Future of Violence. You know, one of the things I think was fascinating with this is, I guess, you know, from my generation anyway, you know, a lot of this technology has come along so fast and we don't understand a lot of it. Like there's the 3D printing, another technology has great potential advances in medicine, science, education. Not something I think I really understand, but it also can be used to create weapons. So I guess it's kind of a twofold here. We need to sort of all of us understand what this technology is, but do you also think the government needs to play a larger role in regulating and overseeing some of these technologies to help prevent against misuse?
My intuition is that the answer is yes. Just, you know, look at the last few weeks. If we go back to the drones issue, there have been several near accidents around New York City airports of collisions between drones and airline passengers. Now, as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't really matter if the drone accidentally takes down a passenger airline or maliciously takes down a passenger airline, we need to make sure that that doesn't happen. And I think, you know, some of us were able to see a drone landing in a stadium during the U.S. Open tennis match. These things, again, if you think about the parallel to cars, they should be regulated and we should have more oversight and regulation. I also thought the one area we haven't talked about yet is the biosecurity sphere. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that in many ways there are some parallels between the conversation that we had about AI and artificial intelligence and the conversation about bioengineering. So there were a lot of anxieties around the cracking of the genome, what is possible and not possible through bioengineering. Are we playing God? What are we doing? What are going to be the longer term consequences? And we've seen that bioengineering has generated lots of amazing benefits to humankind and still is and will likely to continue to do so. But there is an element of real and serious danger here. And in some ways, it's more serious and dangerous than cyber and robotics in the sense that this is really a weapon of mass destruction or potentially has the ability to be a weapon of mass destruction, again, either by malevolent design or just through accidents. And I think it would be reckless to think that we shouldn't be in the business of having some kind of monitoring of research facilities, either in academia or the private sector, even pharmaceutical cosmetics companies that experiment with different agents and try to do different things. I would like, there already is, but I would like to see a serious degree of oversight, cooperation with other countries to see what's happening in other countries and bring all of this in the ambit of this is something that has real potential to wreak security harms and real harms on people, and we need to be serious about how we deal with it.
Mm. You know, when you think of stories of, you know, the mad scientist who wants to take over the world, many, many tales over the years. But one of the things you say in the book is the fantasy's plausibility is more of a reality now.
It's becoming much more of a reality. So when you see, we give a few examples in the book of scientists experimenting with making certain viruses more lethal or more resilient. One experiment was with the H5N1 influenza virus. Another one was with the mousepox virus, initially intended as a pest control means just to not allow or eliminate the ability of mice to procreate. But then it turns out that the engineering was so good that it just killed all the mice. And so what was meant as one type of control became just a lethal, mass lethal capacity. And that knowledge is out in the open. It's published in open science magazines. There was a lot of debate over the H5N1 study, whether to publish it or not publish it. At the end, it was published. I think there was no way around it after the study was presented in academic conferences around the world. By the way, here again, it's not just American scientists. It's American scientists working in collaboration with Germans, Brits, Australians, other teams of scientists around the world. And the question then is how do you mediate between the wish to promote science, allow other scientists access to this knowledge, to benefit from these experiments, and the very serious and threatening and frightening possibility that somebody with ill wishes and ill intentions is going to take that information and put it to very bad use. And just like in the other types of technology, the amount of sophistication that you now need in order to do these things is getting increasingly more accessible and more widely available. More people have the knowledge. We train graduate students all the time and people with scientific knowledge. There is access to the materials through the internet. You can buy strands of DNA on the internet and then you get them shipped to your home. The lab materials are widely available and the science is widely available. And the more access you have, the more you increase the possibility or the probability that somebody out there is going to put it to bad use. Mm.
And as we're saying, a lot of these scenarios are certainly frightening. And you talk about the risk of overreacting. So talk a little bit about that.
That is a very serious risk, and we've seen it historically almost without exception, that something bad happens, we first tend to overreact to the security threat, and we tend to ratchet up our response. And once our response gets ratcheted up, it's very hard to ratchet back down. So once we introduce certain security measures in response to the previous attack, it's very hard to find the political will to take the risk and sort of remove certain things because you're afraid that something bad will happen and then you were negligent. You know, it's not a surprise anymore. You knew. So why are you now removing the defensive mechanism? And as a society, this is one reason or another reason why it's important that we have these conversations now at the point where all the security threats we're describing are there. They exist. We've seen some manifestations of them, but not yet the true catastrophic event. So it's important to have the conversation now about what we need to do to prevent, how we might react in order not to find ourselves in the aftermath of a catastrophic or near catastrophic event and sort of just, you know, shooting everywhere without a coherent idea of it, what we're doing and why.
Mm. You know, as threats arise, there have been corresponding advances to protect us from those threats. For example, the security scans on computers, increase in airline security. So can technology actually provide us with some of the solutions to some of these threats?
Absolutely. So this is not, again, technology is power. And power is not just threatening, it's also defending. The question is, who uses this power and for what purpose? And just as the ability to attack is distributing and growing, so is the ability to defend. And in fact, as you rightly say, a lot of our internet security, for instance, doesn't emanate from the government. It emanates from private companies from whom we purchase software, security software and anti-malware, spyware, etc. Just like for the lock on our doors or our alarm systems, we don't depend on the government. We depend on the private industry. So the same technology that is threatening is also the technology that will provide the defense. The question is, what happens in this arms race between the offensive and defensive capacities? And our concern is that the offensive capacity wins just because all it needs to do is find one area of weakness, one weak link to which it can exploit or through which to infiltrate, while the defender has to imagine defending against all possible threats and all possible scenarios, and that's just much harder. So it's certainly true that we're not defenseless. We don't stand completely naked in front of these threats, but we still think that the threat is significant enough to be a cause for concern and not allow us simply to rely on defensive capacity.
You write, quote, "Much of what we think we know about privacy, liberty, security, and threat is no longer true. Much of what we have been taught about what threatens us, about what protects us, and about the risk and benefits of state power versus individual empowerment is obsolete." You say we need to think about this differently. Maybe you can talk a little bit. How should we be thinking differently?
So if you thought that the Leviathan is there to protect you from your fellow citizens and maybe from other Leviathans attacking you, and then that the Leviathan itself was a source of threat, that threat scenario and the defense scenario or environment is changing. It's changing in the sense that both threats and defenses migrate to individuals, groups, and corporations. And you are now as much dependent and vulnerable and reliant on these other actors as you are in the government, which also means that the things we used to talk about as trade-offs between privacy and security and liberty, it's not the right way to think about it. It's not really the case that we balance one against the other. It's more correct, we argue, to think about it in terms of hostile symbiosis. It's a term we borrow from biology, where the forces are mutually dependent and also sometimes in opposition, but sometimes reinforcing of each other. And again, airport security is a great example. If you want to think about protection of medical records, of your medical records, increasing the safety, the security of the internet systems that store your medical records increases both your privacy and security. You're not trading one against the other. You're actually promoting both. When you submit yourself to airport screening, you're enhancing your liberty to fly as well as your security in doing so. So the combination, instead of thinking about how much privacy do we give up in exchange for security, the conversation needs to be much more, what are the values that you're looking to protect? What are the right mechanisms to protect it? Who are the relevant people who bear a duty to you? It can be the government, but it can also be private corporations. It could be the institution you work for. It could be the people who made the machines you rely on or the people who designed the software. And how do we create a system where all these people bear some duties that are enforceable that keep then allow us all to enjoy the benefits of technology while also keeping us safe as we do so?
That enforceable part, that's a tough cookie to crack.
Very much so. And you mentioned 3D printers. That's a prime example. So if it is becoming possible, and it is becoming possible to print guns in your garage through a 3D printer, and people have proven that that's possible and have demonstrated that, then when you think about the regulation of guns, you're up against a problem. How can you regulate something that people in their garage can just manufacture at home? How effective is that regulation going to be? And that's certainly a challenge.
Yeah. And we're mentioning air travel and the security measures we have. Do you see a time when there will be restrictions on the kinds of technologies that we're able to bring on board aircraft?
Oh, certainly. I certainly think that's the case. A lot of our transportation system, we talked about drones that are sort of an external threat, meaning outside of the airplane or any vehicle. But you can imagine, as the Jeep Cherokee story proves, that you can hack systems. So much of our transportation systems are dependent on such computerized, some of them through cyber systems, that I think hacking becomes a serious, serious security threat.
Yeah. And what do we do about that hack? I mean, hacking is, I mean, that can happen anywhere in the world. We have, you know, young kids who are getting into, you know, corporations and things.
So just as we say about resilience, there is no 100% security. That just doesn't exist. And I'm not sure we would want to live in that kind of world where you guarantee 100% security. We have to accept a certain degree of risk, and that's just the benefits of the costs and benefits of living in a developed and free society. The question is, how much can we do in order to protect these systems and to make sure that the risk is minimized to the highest possible level? I think, you know, protecting these systems from hacking is one very serious endeavor that needs to be undertaken.
Gabriella Blum is the co-author of The Future of Violence, Robots and Germs, Hackers and Drones, Confronting the New Age of Threat, professor of human rights and international humanitarian law at Harvard Law School, and co-director of the Harvard Law School Brookings Project on Law and Security. Thank you so much for joining us. Fascinating read. Really appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
And I want to thank Alan Mattis and Tom Devlin for production assistance in Boston. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.